orders because he can't tender a competitive price at these wage levels.
That's because you've got outdated machinery, Peshkov. Some of these lathes were here before the war.
You need to re-equip.
In the middle of a depression? Are you out of your mind? I'm not going to throw away more money.
That's how your men feel, said Hall, with the air of one who plays a trump card.
They're not going to give money to you when they haven't got enough for themselves.
Greg thought workers were stupid to strike during a depression, and he was angered by Hall's nerve. The man spoke as if he were Lev's equal, not an employee.
Lev said, Well, as things are, we're all losing money. Where's the sense in that?
It's out of my hands now, said Hall.
Greg thought he sounded smug.
The union is sending a team from headquarters to take over.
He pulled a large steel watch out of his waistcoat pocket.
The train should be here in an hour.
Lev's face darkened. We don't need outsiders stirring up trouble.
If you don't want trouble, you shouldn't provoke it.
Lev clenched a fist, but Hall walked away. Lev turned to Brekhunov.
Did you know about these men from headquarters? He said angrily.
Brekhunov looked nervous. I'll get on it right away, boss.
Find out who they are and where they're staying.
Won't be difficult.
Then send them back to New York in a fucking ambulance.
Leave it to me, boss.
Lev turned away and Greg followed him. Now that was power, Greg thought with a touch of awe. His father gave the word, and union officials would be beaten up. They walked outside and got into Lev's car, a Cadillac five-passenger sedan in the new streamlined style. Its long, curving fenders made Greg think of a girl's hips. Lev drove along Porter Avenue to the waterfront and parked at the Buffalo Yacht Club. Sunlight played prettily on the boats in the marina. Greg was pretty sure his father did not belong to this elite club. Gus Dewar must have been a member. They walked onto the pier. The clubhouse was built on pilings over the water. Lev and Greg went inside and checked their hats. Greg immediately felt uneasy, knowing he was a guest in a club that would not have him as a member. The people here probably thought he must feel privileged to be allowed in. He put his hands in his pockets and slouched, so they would know he was not impressed.
I used to belong to this club, Lev said. But in 1921 the chairman told me I had to resign because I was a bootlegger. Then he asked me to sell him a case of scotch.
Why does Senator Dewar want to have lunch with you? Greg asked.
We're about to find out.
Would you mind if I asked him a favor?
Lev frowned.
I guess not.
What are you after?
But before Greg could answer, Lev greeted a man of about 60.
This is Dev Rusrok, he said to Greg. He's my main rival.
You flatter me, the man said.
Rusrok Theaters was a chain of dilapidated movie houses in New York State. The owner was anything but decrepit. He had a patrician air. He was tall and white-haired, with a nose like a curved blade. He wore a blue cashmere blazer with the badge of the club on the breast pocket. Greg said, I had the pleasure of watching your daughter, Joanne, play tennis on Saturday.
Dave was pleased.
Pretty good, isn't she?
Very.
Lev said, I'm glad I ran into you, Dave. I was planning to call you.
Why?
Your theaters need remodeling. They're very old-fashioned.
Dave looked amused. You were planning to call me to give me this news?
Why don't you do something about it?
He shrugged elegantly.
Why bother? I'm making enough money. At my age, I don't want the strain.
You could double your profits.
By raising ticket prices. No thanks.
You're crazy.
Not everyone is obsessed with money, Dave said with a touch of disdain.
Then sell to me, Lev said.
Greg was surprised. He had not seen that coming.
I give you a good price, Lev added.
Dave shook his head.
I like owning cinemas, he said. They give people pleasure.
$8 million, Lev said.
Greg felt bemused. He thought,
did I just hear Father offer Dave $8 million?
That is a fair price, Dave admitted. but I'm not selling.
No one else will give you as much, Lev said with exasperation.
I know. Dave looked as if he had taken enough browbeating. He swallowed the rest of his drink.
Nice to see you both, he said, and he strolled out of the bar into the dining room.
Lev looked disgusted.
Not everyone is obsessed with money, he quoted.
Dave's great-grandfather arrived here from Persia 100 years ago, with nothing but the clothes he wore and 6 rugs. He wouldn't have turned down $8 million.
I didn't know you had that much money, Greg said.
I don't, not in ready cash.
That's what banks are for.
So you'd take out a loan to pay Dave?
Lev raised his forefinger again.
Never use your own money when you can spend someone else's.
Gus Dewar walked in, a tall figure with a large head. He was in his mid-40s, and his light brown hair was salted with silver. He greeted them with cool courtesy, shaking hands and offering them a drink. Greg saw immediately that Gus and Lev did not like one another. He feared that would mean Gus would not grant the favor Greg wanted to beg. Maybe he should give up the thought. Gus was a big shot. His father had been a senator before him, a dynastic succession that Greg thought was un-American. Gus had helped Franklin Roosevelt become governor of New York, and then president. Now he was on the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee. His sons, Woody and Chuck, went to the same school as Greg. Woody was brainy. Chuck was a sportsman. Lev said, "Has the president told you to settle my strike, Senator?" Gus smiled.
"No. Not yet, anyway."
Lev turned to Greg.
"Last time the foundry was on strike, 20 years ago, President Wilson sent Gus to strong-arm me into giving the men a raise."
"I saved you money," Gus said mildly. "They were asking for a dollar. I made them take half that."
"Which was exactly 50 cents more than I intended to give."
Gus smiled and shrugged. "Shall we have lunch?" They went into the dining room. When they had ordered, Gus said, "The president was glad you could make it to the reception at the White House."
"I probably shouldn't have taken Gladys," Lev said. "Mrs. Roosevelt was a bit frosty with her. I guess she doesn't approve of movie stars."
"She probably doesn't approve of movie stars who sleep with married men," Greg thought, but he kept his mouth shut. Gus made small talk while they ate. Greg looked for an opportunity to ask his favor. He wanted to work in Washington one summer, to learn the ropes and make contacts. His father might have been able to get him an internship, but it would have been with a Republican, and they were out of power. Greg wanted to work in the office of the influential and respected Senator Dewar, personal friend and ally of the president. He asked himself why he was nervous about asking. The worst that could happen was that Dewar would say no. When the dessert was finished, Gus got down to business. "The president has asked me to speak to you about the Liberty League," he said. Greg had heard of this organization, a right-wing group opposed to the New Deal. Lev lit a cigarette and blew out smoke. "We have to guard against creeping socialism. The New Deal is all that is saving us from the kind of nightmare they're having in Germany. The Liberty League aren't Nazis."
"Aren't they? They have a plan for an armed insurrection to overthrow the president. It's not realistic, of course. Not yet, anyway."
"I believe I have a right to my opinions."
"Then you're supporting the wrong people. The League has nothing to do with liberty, you know."
"Don't talk to me about liberty," Lev said with a touch of anger. "When I was 12 years old, I was flogged by the Leningrad police because my parents were on strike."
Greg was not sure why his father had said that. The brutality of the Tsar's regime seemed like an argument for socialism, not against.
Gus said, "Roosevelt knows you give money to the League, and he wants you to stop."
"How does he know who I give money to?"
"The FBI told him. They investigate such people."
"We're living in a police state. You're supposed to be a liberal."
There was not much logic to Lev's arguments, Greg perceived. Lev was just trying everything he could think of to wrong-foot Gus. And he did not care if he contradicted himself in the process.
Gus remained cool. "I'm trying to make sure this doesn't become a matter for the police," he said. Lev grinned. "Does the president know I stole your fiancé?" This was news to Greg, but it had to be true, for Lev had at last succeeded in throwing Gus off balance. Gus looked shocked, turned his gaze aside, and reddened. "Score one for our team," Greg thought. Lev explained to Greg. "Gus was engaged to Olga back in 1915, he said. "Then she changed her mind and married me." Gus recovered his composure. "We were all terribly young." Lev said, "You certainly got over Olga quickly enough." Gus gave Lev a cool look and said, "So did you." Greg saw that his father was embarrassed now. Gus's shot had hit home. There was a moment of awkward silence. Then Gus said, "You and I fought in a war, Lev. I was in a machine gun battalion with my school friend, Chuck Dixon, in a little French town called Chateau Thierry. He was blown to pieces in front of my eyes." Gus was speaking in a conversational tone, but Greg found himself holding his breath. Gus went on, "My ambition for my sons is that they should never have to go through what we went through. That's why groups such as the Liberty League have to be nipped in the bud." Greg saw his chance. "I'm interested in politics too, Senator, and I'd like to learn more. Might you be able to take me as an intern one summer?" He held his breath. Gus looked surprised, but said, "I can always use a bright young man who's willing to work in a team." That was neither a yes or a no. "I'm top in math and captain of ice hockey," Greg persisted, selling himself. "Ask Woody about me."
"I will."
Gus turned to Lev. "And will you consider the president's request? It's really very important." It almost seemed as if Gus was suggesting an exchange of favors. But would Lev agree? Lev hesitated a long moment, then stubbed out his cigarette and said, "I guess we have a deal." Gus stood up. "Good," he said. "The president will be pleased." Greg thought, "I did it." They walked out of the club to their cars. As they drove out of the parking lot, Greg said, "Thank you, Father. I really appreciate what you did."
"You chose your moment well," Lev said. "I'm glad to see you're so smart."
The compliment pleased Greg. In some ways, he was smarter than his father. He certainly understood science and math better, but he feared he was not as shrewd and cunning as his old man.
"I want you to be a wise guy,"
Lev went on, "not like some of these dummies." Greg had no idea who the dummies were.
"You gotta stay ahead of the curve all the time. That's the way to get on."
Lev drove to his office, in a modern block downtown. As they walked through the marble lobby, Lev said, "Now I'm going to teach a lesson to that fool Dave Rusrak." Going up in the elevator, Greg wondered how Lev would do that. Peshkov Pictures occupied the top floor. Greg followed Lev along a broad corridor and through an outer office with two attractive young secretaries. "Get Sol Star on the phone, will you?" Lev said as they walked into the inner office. Lev sat behind the desk. "Salion's one of the biggest studios in Hollywood," he explained. The phone on the desk rang and Lev picked it up.
"Sol," he said, "how are they hanging?"
Greg listened to a minute or two of masculine joshing. Then Lev got down to business.
"Little piece of advice," he said. "Here in New York State, we have a crappy chain of flea pits called Rose Rock Theaters." "Yeah, that's the one. Take my tip. Don't send them your top-of-the-line first-run pictures this summer. You may not get paid."
Greg realized that would hit Dave hard. Without exciting new movies to show, his takings would tumble.
"A word to the wise, right? Sally, don't thank me. You do the same for me. Bye."
Once again, Greg was awestruck by his father's power. He could have people beaten up. He could offer $8 million of other people's money. He could scare a president. He could seduce another man's fiancée. And he could ruin a business with a single phone call.
"You wait and see," said his father,
In a month's time, Dave Ruzrock will be begging me to buy him out at half the price I offered him today.
3.
I don't know what's wrong with this puppy, Daisy said. He won't do anything I tell him. I'm going crazy.
There was a shake in her voice and a tear in her eye, and she was exaggerating only a little. Charlie Farquharson studied the dog.
There's nothing wrong with him, he said. He's a lovely little fellow.
What's his name?
Jack.
They were sitting on lawn chairs in the well-kept two-acre garden of Daisy's home. Ava had greeted Charlie, then tactfully retired to write a letter home. The gardener, Henry, was hoeing a bed of purple and yellow pansies in the distance. His wife, Ella, the maid, brought a pitcher of lemonade and some glasses, and set them on a folding table. The puppy was a tiny Jack Russell Terrier, small and strong, white with tan patches. He had an intelligent look, as if he understood every word, but he seemed to have no inclination to obey. Daisy held him on her lap and stroked his nose with dainty fingers in a way that she hoped Charlie would find strangely disturbing.
Don't you like the name?
A bit obvious, perhaps?
Charlie stared at her white hand on the dog's nose, and shifted uneasily in his chair. Daisy did not want to overdo it. If she inflamed Charlie too much, he would just go home. This was why he was still single at 25. Several Buffalo girls, including Dot Renshaw and Muffy Dixon, had found it impossible to nail his foot to the floor. But Daisy was different.
Then you shall name him, she said.
It's good to have two syllables, as in Bonzo, to make it easier for him to recognize the name.
Daisy had no idea how to name dogs.
How about Rover?
Too common. Rusty might be better.
Perfect, she said. Rusty he shall be.
The dog wriggled effortlessly out of her grasp and jumped to the ground. Charlie picked him up. Daisy noticed he had big hands.
You must show Rusty you're the boss, Charlie said. Hold him tight, and don't let him jump down until you say so.
He put the dog back on her lap.
But he's so strong, and I'm afraid of hurting him.
Charlie smiled condescendingly.
You probably couldn't hurt him if you tried. Hold his collar tightly. Twist it a bit, if you need to. Then put your other hand firmly on his back.
Daisy followed Charlie's orders. The dog sensed the increased pressure in her touch and became still, as if waiting to see what would happen next.
Tell him to sit, then press down on his rear end.
Sit, she said.
Say it louder, and pronounce the letter T very clearly, then press down hard.
Sit, Rusty, she said,
and pushed him down. He sat.
There you are, said Charlie.
You're so clever, Daisy gashed.
Charlie looked pleased. It's just a matter of knowing what to do, he said modestly. You must always be emphatic and decisive with dogs. You have to almost bark at them. He sat back, looking content. He was quite heavy and filled the chair. Talking about the subject in which he was expert had relaxed him, as Daisy had hoped. She had called him that morning.
I'm in despair, she had said.
I have a new puppy and I can't manage him at all.
Can you give me any advice?
What breed of puppy?
It's a Jack Russell.
Why, that's the kind of dog I like best. I have three.
What a coincidence.
As Daisy had hoped, Charlie volunteered to come over and help her train the dog. Ava had said doubtfully,
Do you really think Charlie is right for you?
Are you kidding?
Daisy had replied. He's one of the most eligible bachelors in Buffalo. Now she said,
I bet you'd be really good with children, too.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You love dogs, but you're firm with them. I'm sure that works with children, too.
I have no idea. He changed the subject. Are you intending to go to college in September?
I might go to Oakdale. It's a 2-year finishing college for ladies. Unless...
Unless what? Unless I get married, she meant. But she said,
I don't know. Unless something else happens.
Such as what?
I'd like to see England. My father went to London and met the Prince of Wales. What about you? Any plans?
It was always assumed I would take over Father's bank, but now there is no bank. Mother has a little money from her family, and I manage that, but otherwise I'm kind of a loose wheel.
You should raise horses, Daisy said. I know you'd be good at it.
She was a good rider and had won prizes when younger. She pictured herself and Charlie in the park on matching greys, with two children on ponies following behind. The vision gave her a warm glow. I love horses, Charlie said.
So do I. I want to breed racehorses.
Daisy did not have to feign this enthusiasm. It was her dream to raise a string of champions. She saw racehorse owners as the ultimate international elite. Thoroughbreds cost a lot of money, Charlie said lugubriously. Daisy had plenty. If Charlie married her, he would never have to worry about money again. She naturally did not say so, but she guessed Charlie was thinking it, and she let the thought hang unspoken in the air for as long as possible. Eventually, Charlie said, Did your father really have those two union organizers beaten up?
What a strange idea!
Daisy did not know whether Lev Peshkov had done any such thing, but in truth it would not have surprised her. The men who came from New York to take over the strike, Charlie persisted. They were hospitalized. The Sentinel says they quarreled with local union leaders, but everyone thinks your father was responsible.
I never talk about politics, Daisy said gaily. When did you get your first dog?
Charlie began a long reminiscence. Daisy considered what to do next.
I've got him here, she thought, and put him at ease. Now I have to get him aroused.
But stroking the dog suggestively had unnerved him. What they needed was some casual physical contact.
What should I do next with Rusty?
She asked when Charlie had finished his story. Teach him to walk to heel, Charlie said promptly.
How do you do that?
Do you have some dog biscuits?
Sure.
The kitchen windows were open, and Daisy raised her voice so that the maid could hear her.
Ella, would you kindly bring me that box of milk bones?
Charlie broke up one of the biscuits, then took the dog on his lap. He held a piece of biscuit in his closed fist, letting Rusty sniff it, then opened his hand and allowed the dog to eat the morsel. He took another piece, making sure the dog knew he had it. Then he stood up and put the dog at his feet. Rusty kept an alert gaze on Charlie's closed fist. Walk to heel, Charlie said, and walked a few steps. The dog followed him. Good boy, Charlie said, and gave Rusty the biscuit.
That's amazing, Daisy said.
After a while, you won't need the biscuit. He'll do it for a pet. Then eventually he'll do it automatically.
Charlie, you're a genius.
Charlie looked pleased. He had nice brown eyes, just like the dog, she observed. Now you try, he said to Daisy. She copied what Charlie had done and achieved the same result. See, said Charlie, it's not so hard. Daisy laughed with delight.
We should go into business, she said.
Farquharson and Peshkov, dog trainers.
What a nice idea, he said, and he seemed to mean it.
This is going very well, Daisy thought.
She went to the table and poured two glasses of lemonade. Standing beside her, he said,
I'm usually a bit shy with girls.
No kidding, she thought, but she kept her mouth firmly closed. But you're so easy to talk to, he went on. He imagined that was a happy accident. As she handed a glass to him, she fumbled, spilling lemonade on him.
Oh, how clumsy, she cried.
It's nothing, he said. But the drink had wetted his linen blazer and his white cotton trousers. He pulled out a handkerchief and began to mop it.
Here, let me, said Daisy,
and she took the handkerchief from his large hand. She moved intimately close to pat his lapel. He went still, and she knew he could smell her Jean Nattei perfume, lavender notes on top, musk underneath. She brushed the handkerchief caressingly over the front of his jacket, though there was no spill there.
Almost done, she said,
as if she regretted having to stop soon.
Then she went down on one knee as if worshipping him. She began to blot the wet patches on his pants with butterfly lightness. As she stroked his thigh, she put on a look of alluring innocence and glanced up. He was staring down at her, breathing hard through his open mouth, mesmerized.
4. Woody Doer impatiently inspected the yacht Sprinter, checking that the kids had made everything ship-shape. She was a 48-foot racing ketch, long and slender like a knife. Dave Ruzronk had loaned her to the shipmates, a club Woody belonged to that took the sons of Buffalo's unemployed out on Lake Erie and taught them the rudiments of sailing. Woody was glad to see that the dock lines and fenders were set, the sails furled, the halyards tied off, and all the other lines neatly coiled. His brother, Chuck, a year younger at 14, was on the dock already, joshing with a couple of colored kids. Chuck had an easygoing manner that enabled him to get on with everyone. Woody, who wanted to go into politics like their father, envied Chuck's effortless charm. The boys wore nothing but shorts and sandals, and the three on the dock looked a picture of youthful strength and vitality. Woody would have liked to take a photograph, if he had had his camera with him. He was a keen photographer and had built a darkroom at home, so that he could develop and print his own pictures. Satisfied that the Sprinter was being left as they had found her that morning, Woody jumped onto the dock. A group of a dozen youngsters left the boatyard together, windswept and sunburned, aching pleasantly from their exertions, laughing as they relived the day's blunders and pratfalls and jokes. The gap between the two rich brothers and the crowd of poor boys had vanished when they were out on the water, working together to control the yacht, but now it reappeared in the parking lot of the Buffalo Yacht Club. Two vehicles stood side by side. Senator Doer's Chrysler Airflow, with a uniformed chauffeur at the wheel for Woody and Chuck, and a Chevrolet Roadster pickup truck with two wooden benches in the back for the others. Woody felt embarrassed, saying goodbye as the chauffeur held the door for him, but the boys did not seem to care, thanking him and saying, "See you next Saturday." As they drove up Delaware Avenue, Woody said, "That was fun, though I'm not sure how much good it does." Chuck was surprised. "Why?" "Well, we're not helping their fathers find jobs, and that's the only thing that really counts."
"It might help the sons get work in a few years' time."
Buffalo was a port city. In normal times, there were thousands of jobs on merchant ships plying the Great Lakes and the Erie Canal, as well as on pleasure craft. "Provided the president can get the economy moving again," Chuck shrugged. "So go work for Roosevelt."
"Why not? Papa worked for Woodrow Wilson."
"I'll stick with the sailing."
Woody checked his wristwatch. "We've got time to change for the ball, just." They were going to a dinner dance at the racquet club. Anticipation made his heart beat faster.
"I want to be with humans that have soft skin, speak with high voices, and wear pink dresses."
"Huh," Chuck said derisively. "Joanne Ruzrock never wore pink in her life."
Woody was taken aback. He had been dreaming about Joanne all day and half the night for a couple of weeks. But how did his brother know that?
"What makes you think?" "Oh, come on," Chuck said scornfully. "When she arrived at the beach party in a tennis skirt, you practically fainted. Everyone could see you were crazy about her. Fortunately, she didn't seem to notice."
"Why was that fortunate?"
"For God's sake, you're 15 and she's 18. It's embarrassing. She's looking for a husband, not a schoolboy."
"Oh, gee, thanks. I forgot what an expert you are on women." Chuck flushed. He had never had a girlfriend.
"You don't have to be an expert to see what's under your goddamn nose."
They talked like this all the time. There was no malice in it. They were just brutally frank with each other. They were brothers, so there was no need to be nice. They reached home, a mock Gothic mansion built by their late grandfather, Senator Cam Doer. They ran inside to shower and change. Woody was now the same height as his father, and he put on one of Papa's old dress suits. It was a bit worn, but that was all right. The younger boys would be wearing school suits or blazers, but the college men would have tuxedos, and Woody was keen to look older. Tonight he would dance with her, he thought,
as he slicked his hair with brilliantine. He would be allowed to hold her in his arms. The palms of his hands would feel the warmth of her skin. He would look into her eyes as she smiled. Her breasts would brush against his jacket as they danced. When he came down, his parents were waiting in the drawing room. Papa drinking a cocktail, Mama smoking a cigarette. Papa was long and thin, and looked like a coat hanger in his double-breasted tuxedo. Mama was beautiful, despite having only one eye, the other being permanently closed. She had been born that way. Tonight she looked stunning in a floor-length dress, black lace over red silk, and a short black velvet evening jacket. Woody's grandmother was the last to arrive. At 68, she was poised and elegant, as thin as her son, but petite. She studied Mama's dress and said, "Rosa, dear, you look wonderful." She was always kind to her daughter-in-law. To everyone else, she was waspish. Gus made her a cocktail without being asked. Woody hid his impatience while she took her time drinking it. Grandmama would never be hurried. She assumed no social event would begin before she arrived. She was the grand old lady of Buffalo society, widow of a senator and mother of another, matriarch of one of the city's oldest and most distinguished families. Woody asked himself when he had fallen for Joanne. He had known her most of his life, but he had always regarded girls as uninteresting spectators to the exciting adventures of boys, until 2 or 3 years ago, when girls had suddenly become even more fascinating than cars and speedboats. Even then, he had been more interested in girls his own age, or a little younger. Joanne, for her part, had always treated him as a kid. A bright kid, worth talking to now and again, but certainly not a possible boyfriend. But this summer, for no reason he could put a finger on, he had suddenly begun to see her as the most alluring girl in the world. Sadly, her feelings for him had not undergone a similar transformation. Not yet. Grandmama addressed a question to his brother. "How is school, Jack?"
"Terrible, Grandmama, as you know perfectly well. I'm the family cretin, a throwback to our chimpanzee forebears."
"Cretins don't use phrases such as our chimpanzee forebears, in my experience. Are you quite sure laziness plays no part?"
Rosa butted in. "Chuck's teachers say he works pretty hard at school, Mama." Gus added, "And he beats me at chess."
"Then I ask what the problem is," Grandmama persisted. "If this goes on, he won't get into Harvard."
Chuck said, "I'm a slow reader, that's all."
"Curious," she said. "My father-in-law, your paternal great-grandfather, was the most successful banker of his generation, yet he could barely read or write."
Chuck said, "I didn't know that."
"It's true," she said, "but don't use it as an excuse. Work harder."
Gus looked at his watch. "If you're ready, Mama, we'd better go." At last, they got into the car and drove to the club. Papa had taken a table for the dinner and invited the Renshaws and their offspring, Dot and George. Woody looked around, but to his disappointment, he did not see Joanne. He checked the table plan on an easel in the lobby, and was dismayed to see that there was no Ruse Rock table. Were they not coming? That would ruin his evening. The talk over the lobster and steak was of events in Germany. Philip Renshaw thought Hitler was doing a good job. Woody's father said, "According to today's Sentinel, they jailed a Catholic priest for criticizing the Nazis."
"Are you Catholic?" said Mr. Renshaw in surprise.
"No, Episcopalian."
"It's not about religion, Philip," said Rosa crisply. "It's about freedom."
Woody's mother had been an anarchist in her youth, and she was still a libertarian at heart. Some people skipped the dinner and came later for the dancing, and more revelers appeared as the doers were served dessert. Woody kept his eyes peeled for Joanne. In the next room, a band started to play The Continental, a hit from last year. He could not say what it was about Joanne that had so captivated him. Most people would not call her a great beauty, though she was certainly striking. She looked like an Aztec queen, with high cheekbones and the same knife-blade nose as her father, Dave. Her hair was dark and thick, and her skin an olive shade.
no doubt because of her Persian ancestry. There was a brooding intensity about her that made Woody long to know her better, to make her relax and hear her murmur softly about nothing in particular. He felt that her formidable presence might signify a capacity for deep passion. Then he thought, now who's pretending to be an expert on women?
"Are you looking out for someone, Woody?" said Grandmama, who did not miss much.
Chuck sniggered knowingly. "Just wondering who's coming to the dance?" Woody replied casually, but he could not help blushing. He still had not spotted her when his mother stood up and they all left the table. Disconsolate, he wandered into the ballroom to the strains of Benny Goodman's Moonglow. And there Joanne was. She must have come in when he was not looking. His spirits lifted. Tonight she wore a dramatically simple silver-gray silk dress with a deep V-neck that showed off her figure. She had looked sensational in a tennis skirt that revealed her long brown legs, but this was even more arousing. As she glided across the room, graceful and confident, she made Woody's throat go dry. He moved toward her, but the ballroom had filled up, and suddenly he was irritatingly popular. Everyone wanted to talk to him. During his progress through the crowd, he was surprised to see dull old Charlie Farquharson dancing with the vivacious Daisy Peshkov. He could not recall seeing Charlie dance with anyone, let alone a Tootsie like Daisy. What had she done to bring him out of his shell? By the time he reached Joanne, she was at the end of the room farthest from the band, and to his chagrin she was deep in discussion with a group of boys 4 or 5 years older than he. Fortunately, he was taller than most of them, so the difference was not too obvious. They were all holding Coke glasses, but Woody could smell scotch. One of them must have had a bottle in his pocket. As he joined them, he heard Victor Dixon say, "No one's in favor of lynching, but you have to understand the problems they have in the South." Woody knew that Senator Wagner had proposed a law to punish sheriffs who permitted lynchings, but President Roosevelt had refused to back the bill. Joanne was outraged.
"How can you say that, Victor? Lynching is murder. We don't have to understand their problems. We have to stop them killing people."
Woody was pleased to learn how much Joanne shared his political values. But clearly this was not a good time to ask her to dance, which was unfortunate.
"You don't get it, Joanne, honey," said Victor. "Those southern Negroes are not really civilized."
"I might be young and inexperienced," Woody thought, "but I wouldn't have made the mistake of speaking so condescendingly to Joanne."
"It's the people who carry out lynchings who are uncivilized," she said.
Woody decided this was the moment to make his contribution to the argument. "Joanne is right," he said. He made his voice lower in pitch to sound older. "There was a lynching in the hometown of our help, Joe and Betty, who have looked after me and my brother since we were babies. Betty's cousin was stripped naked and burned with a blowtorch, while a crowd watched. Then he was hanged." Victor glared at him, resentful of this kid who was taking Joanne's attention away. But the others in the group listened with horrified interest.
"I don't care what his crime was," Woody said. "The white people who did that to him are savages."
Victor said, "Your beloved President Roosevelt didn't support the anti-lynch bill, though, did he?"
"No, and that was very disappointing," said Woody. "I know why he made that decision. He was afraid that angry Southern congressmen would retaliate by sabotaging the New Deal. All the same, I would have liked him to tell them to go to hell."
Victor said, "What do you know? You're just a kid."
He took a silver flask from his jacket pocket and topped up his drink. Joanne said, "Woody's political ideas are more grown up than yours, Victor." Woody glowed.
"Politics is kind of the family business," he said. Then he was irritated by a tug at his elbow. Too polite to ignore it, he turned to see Charlie Farquharson, perspiring from his exertions on the dance floor.
"Can I talk to you for a minute?" said Charlie.
Woody resisted the temptation to tell him to buzz off. Charlie was a likable guy who did no harm to anyone. You had to feel sorry for a man with a mother like that.
"What is it, Charlie?"
he said with as much good grace as he could muster.
"It's about Daisy."
"I saw you dancing with her."
"Isn't she a great dancer?"
Woody had not noticed, but to be nice, he said, "You bet she is."
She's great at everything.
Charlie, said Woody, trying to suppress a tone of incredulity, are you and Daisy courting? Charlie looked bashful.
We've been horse riding in the park a couple of times and so on.
So you are courting? Woody was surprised. They seemed an unlikely pair. Charlie was such a lump, and Daisy was a puppet. Charlie added,
she's not like other girls. She's so easy to talk to, and she loves dogs and horses, but people think her father is a gangster.
I guess he is a gangster, Charlie. Everyone bought their liquor from him during Prohibition.
That's what my mother says.
So your mother doesn't like Daisy? Woody was not surprised.
She likes Daisy fine. It's Daisy's family she objects to.
An even more surprising thought occurred to Woody. Are you thinking of marrying Daisy?
Oh, God, yes, said Charlie. And I think she might say yes if I asked her.
Well, Woody thought, Charlie had class but no money, and Daisy was the opposite, so maybe they would complement one another. Stranger things have happened, he said. This was kind of fascinating, but he wanted to concentrate on his own romantic life. He looked around, checking that Joanne was still there.
Why are you telling me this?
He asked Charlie. It was not as if they were great friends.
My mother might change her mind if Mrs. Peshkov were invited to join the Buffalo Ladies' Society.
Woody had not been expecting that. Why, it's the snobbiest club in town.
Exactly.
If Olga Peshkov were a member, how could Mom object to Daisy? Woody did not know whether this scheme would work or not, but there was no doubting the earnest warmth of Charlie's feelings.
Maybe you're right, Woody said. Would you approach your grandmother for me?
Whoa, wait a minute. Grandmama Dewar is a dragon. I wouldn't ask her for a favor for myself, let alone for you.
Woody, listen to me. You know she's really the boss of that little clique. If she wants someone, they're in, and if she doesn't, they're out.
That was true. The society had a chairwoman and a secretary and a treasurer, but Ursula Dewar ran the club as if it belonged to her. All the same, Woody was reluctant to petition her. She might bite his head off.
I don't know, he said apologetically. Oh, come on, Woody, please. You don't understand.
Charlie lowered his voice.
You don't know what it's like to love someone this much.
Yes, I do, Woody thought, and that changed his mind. If Charlie feels as bad as I do, how can I refuse him? I hope someone else would do the same for me, if it meant I had a better chance with Joanne.
Okay, Charlie, he said. I'll talk to her. Thanks. Say, she's here, isn't she? Could you do it tonight?
Hell no. I've got other things on my mind.
Okay, sure. But when?
Woody shrugged. I'll do it tomorrow.
You're a pal.
Don't thank me yet. She'll probably say no. Woody turned back to speak to Joanne, but she had gone. He began to look for her, then stopped himself. He must not appear desperate. A needy man was not sexy. He knew that much. He danced dutifully with several girls, Dot Renshaw, Daisy Peshkov, and Daisy's German friend, Ava. He got a Coke and went outside to where some of the boys were smoking cigarettes. George Renshaw poured some scotch into Woody's Coke, which improved the taste, but he did not want to get drunk. He had done it before, and he did not like it. Joanne would want a man who shared her intellectual interests, Woody believed, and that would rule out Victor Dixon. Woody had heard Joanne mention Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud. In the public library, he had read the Communist Manifesto, but it just seemed like a political rant. He had had more fun with Freud's Studies in Hysteria, which made a kind of detective story out of mental illness. He was looking forward to letting Joanne know, in a casual way, that he had read these books. He was determined to dance with Joanne at least once tonight, and after a while he went in search of her. She was not in the ballroom or the bar. Had he missed his chance? In trying not to show his desperation, had he been too passive? It was unbearable to think that the ball could end without his even having touched her shoulder.
He stepped outside again. It was dark, but he saw her almost immediately. She was walking away from Greg Peshkov, looking a little flushed, as if she had been arguing with him.
"You might be the only person here who isn't a goddamn conservative," she said to Woody. She sounded a little drunk.
Woody smiled. "Thanks for the compliment, I think.
Do you know about the march tomorrow?"
she asked abruptly. He did. Strikers from the Buffalo Metalworks planned a demonstration to protest against the beating up of union men from New York. Woody guessed that was the subject of her argument with Greg. His father owned the factory. "I was planning to go," he said. "I might take some photographs."
"Bless you,"
she said, and she kissed him. He was so surprised that he almost failed to respond. For a second, he stood there passively as she crushed her mouth to his, and he tasted whiskey on her lips. Then he recovered his composure. He put his arms around her and pressed her body to his, feeling her breasts and her thighs pressed delightfully against him. Part of him feared she would be offended, push him away, and angrily accuse him of treating her disrespectfully. But a deeper instinct told him he was on safe ground. He had little experience of kissing girls, and none of kissing mature women of 18, but he liked the feel of her soft mouth so much that he moved his lips against hers in little nibbling motions that gave him exquisite pleasure, and he was rewarded by hearing her moan quietly. He was vaguely aware that if one of the older generation should walk by, there might be an embarrassing scene, but he was too aroused to care. Joanne's mouth opened, and he felt her tongue. This was new to him. The few girls he had kissed had not done that, but he figured she must know what she was doing, and anyway he really liked it. He imitated the motions of her tongue with his own. It was shockingly intimate and highly exciting. It must have been the right thing to do, because she moaned again. Summoning his nerve, he put his right hand on her left breast. It was wonderfully soft and heavy under the silk of her dress. As he caressed it, he felt a small protuberance and thought, with a thrill of discovery, that it must be her nipple. He rubbed it with his thumb. She pulled away from him abruptly.
"Good God," she said, "what am I doing?"
"You're kissing me," Woody said happily. He rested his hands on her round hips. He could feel the heat of her skin through the silk dress. "Let's do it some more." She pushed his hands away.
"I must be out of my mind. This is the racket club, for Christ's sake."
Woody could see that the spell had been broken, and sadly there would be no more kissing tonight. He looked around. "Don't worry," he said. "No one saw." He felt enjoyably conspiratorial.
"I'd better go home before I do something even more stupid."
He tried not to be offended.
"May I escort you to your car?" "Are you crazy? If we walk in there together, everyone will guess what we've been doing, especially with that damn grin all over your face."
Woody tried to stop grinning. "Then why don't you go inside, and I'll wait out here for a minute."
"Good idea."
She walked away. "See you tomorrow," he called after her. She did not look back. 5. Ursula Duer had her own small suite of rooms in the old Victorian mansion on Delaware Avenue. There was a bedroom, a bathroom, and a dressing room, and after her husband died, she had converted his dressing room into a little parlor. Most of the time she had the whole house to herself. Gus and Rosa spent a lot of time in Washington, and Woody and Chuck went to a boarding school. But when they came home, she spent a good deal of the day in her own quarters. Woody went to talk to her on Sunday morning. He was still walking on air after Joanne's kiss, though he had spent half the night trying to figure out what it meant. It could signify anything from true love to true drunkenness. All he knew was that he could hardly wait to see Joanne again. He walked into his grandmother's room behind the maid, Betty, as she took in the breakfast tray. He liked it that Joanne got angry about the way Betty's southern relations were treated. In politics, dispassionate argument was overrated, he felt. People should get angry about cruelty and injustice. Grandmama was already sitting up in bed, wearing a lace shawl over a mushroom-colored silk nightgown.
"Good morning, Woodrow,"
she said, surprised. I'd like to have a cup of coffee with you, Grandmama, if I may. He had already asked Betty to bring two cups.
This is an honor, Ursula said.
Betty was a gray-haired woman of about 50, with the kind of figure that was sometimes called comfortable. She set the tray in front of Ursula, and Woody poured coffee into Meissen cups. He had given some thought to what he would say, and had marshaled his arguments. Prohibition was over, and Lev Peshkov was now a legitimate businessman, he would contend. Furthermore, it was not fair to punish Daisy because her father had been a criminal, especially since most of the respectable families in Buffalo had bought his illegal booze.
Do you know Charlie Farquharson? He began.
Yes. Of course she did. She knew every family in the Buffalo Blue Book. She said, Would you like a piece of this toast?
No, thank you. I've had breakfast.
Boys of your age never have enough to eat. She looked at him shrewdly. Unless they're in love. She was in good form this morning. Woody said, Charlie is kind of under the thumb of his mother.
She kept her husband there, too, Ursula said dryly. Dying was the only way he could get free.
She drank some coffee and started to eat her grapefruit with a fork. Charlie came to me last night and asked me to ask you a favor. She raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. Woody took a breath. He wants you to invite Mrs. Peshkov to join the Buffalo Ladies' Society. Ursula dropped her fork, and there was a chime of silver on fine porcelain. As if covering her discomposure, she said, Pour me some more coffee, please, Woody. He did her bidding, saying nothing for the moment. He could not recall ever seeing her discombobulated. She sipped the coffee and said, Why in the name of heaven would Charles Farquharson, or anyone else for that matter, want Olga Peshkov in the society?
He wants to marry Daisy.
Does he? And he's afraid his mother will object.
He's got that part right.
But he thinks he might be able to talk her around.
If I let Olga into the society,
then people might forget that her father was a gangster.
A gangster?
Well, a bootlegger at least.
Oh, that, Ursula said dismissively. That's not it.
Really? It was Woody's turn to be surprised. What is it, then? Ursula looked thoughtful. She was silent for such a long time that Woody wondered if she had forgotten he was there. Then she said,
Your father was in love with Olga Peshkov.
Jesus!
Don't be vulgar.
Sorry, Grandmama. You surprised me.
They were engaged to be married.
Engaged? He said, astonished. He thought for a minute, then said, I suppose I'm the only person in Buffalo who doesn't know about this.
She smiled at him. There is a special mixture of wisdom and innocence that comes only to adolescence. I remember it so clearly in your father, and I see it in you.
Yes, everyone in Buffalo knows, though your generation undoubtedly regarded as boring ancient history.
Well, what happened? Woody said. I mean, who broke it off?
She did, when she got pregnant. Woody's mouth fell open.
By Papa?
No, by her chauffeur, Lev Peshkov.
He was the chauffeur?
This was one shock after another. Woody was silent, trying to take it in.
My goodness, Papa must have felt such a fool.
Your Papa was never a fool, Ursula said sharply. The only foolish thing he did in his life was propose to Olga.
Woody remembered his mission. All the same, Grandmama, it was an awful long time ago.
Awfully. You require an adverb, not an adjective. But your judgment is better than your grammar. It is a long time.
That sounded hopeful. So you'll do it.
How do you think your father would feel?
Woody considered. He could not bullshit Ursula. She would see through it in a heartbeat.
Would he care? I guess he might be embarrassed. if Olga were around as a constant reminder of a humiliating episode in his youth.
You guess right.
On the other hand, he's very committed to the ideal of behaving fairly to the people around him. He hates injustice. He wouldn't want to punish Daisy for something her mother did, even less to punish Charlie. Papa has a pretty big heart.
Bigger than mine, you mean, said Ursula.
I didn't mean that, Grandmama, but I bet if you asked him, he wouldn't object to Olga joining the society.
Ursula nodded. I agree, but I wonder whether you've worked out who is the real originator of this request.
Woody saw what she was driving at.
Oh,
you're saying Daisy put Charlie up to it. I wouldn't be surprised. Does it make any difference to the rights and wrongs of the situation?
I guess not.
So, will you do it?
I'm glad to have a grandson with a kind heart, even if I do suspect he's being used by a clever and ambitious girl.
Woody smiled. Is that a yes, Grandmama?
You know I can't guarantee anything. I'll suggest it to the committee.
Ursula's suggestions were regarded by everyone else as royal commands, but Woody did not say so.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Now give me a kiss and get ready for church.
Woody made his escape. He quickly forgot about Charlie and Daisy. Sitting in the Cathedral of St. Paul in Shelton Square, he ignored the sermon about Noah and the flood, and thought about Joanne Rusrock. Her parents were in church, but she was not. Would she really show up at the demonstration? If she did, he was going to ask her for a date. But would she accept? She was too smart to care about the age difference, he reckoned. She must have known she had more in common with Woody than with boneheads such as Victor Dixon. And that kiss. He was still tingling from it. What she had done with her tongue. Did other girls do that? He wanted to try it again as soon as he could. Thinking ahead, if she did agree to date him, what would happen in September? She was going to Vassar College, in the town of Poughkeepsie. He knew that. He would return to school and not see her until Christmas. Vassar was for girls only, but there must be men in Poughkeepsie. Would she date other guys? He was jealous already. Outside the church, he told his parents he was not coming home for lunch, but was going on the protest march.
Good for you, his mother said.
When Yang Shi had been the editor of the Buffalo Anarchist, she turned to her husband.
You should go too, Gus.
The union has brought charges, Papa said. You know I can't prejudge the result of a court case.
She turned back to Woody. Just don't get beaten up by Lev Peshkov's goons. Woody got his camera out of the trunk of his father's car. It was a Leica 3, so small he could carry it on a strap around his neck, yet it had shutter speeds as fast as 1/500th of a second. He walked a few blocks to Niagara Square, where the march was to begin. Lev Peshkov had tried to persuade the city to ban the demonstration on the grounds that it would lead to violence, but the union had insisted it would be peaceful. The union seemed to have won that argument, for several hundred people were milling around outside City Hall. Many carried lovingly embroidered banners, red flags, and placards reading, "Say no to boss thugs." Woody looked around for Joanne but did not see her. The weather was fine, and the mood was sunny, and he took a few shots. Workmen in their Sunday suits and hats, a car festooned with banners, a young cop biting his nails. There was still no sign of Joanne, and he began to think she would not appear. She might have a headache this morning, he guessed. The march was due to move off at noon. It finally got going a few minutes before one. There was a heavy police presence along the route, Woody noted. He found himself near the middle of the procession. As they walked south on Washington Street, heading for the city's industrial heartland, he saw Joanne join the march a few yards ahead, and his heart leaped. She was wearing tailored pants that flattered her figure. He hurried to catch up with her.
Good afternoon, he said happily.
Good grief, you're cheerful, she said. It was an understatement. He was delirious with happiness.
Are you hungover?
Either that or I've contracted the Black Death.
Which do you think it is?
If you have a rash, it's the Black Death.
Are there any spots? Woody hardly knew what he was saying. I'm not a doctor, but I'd be happy to check you over.
Stop being irrepressible. I know it's charming, but I'm not in the mood.
Woody tried to calm down. We missed you in church, he said. The sermon was about Noah. To his consternation, she burst out laughing.
Oh, Woody, she said. I like you so much when you're funny, but please don't make me laugh today.
He thought this remark was probably favorable, but he was far from certain. He spotted an open grocery store on a side street. You need fluids, he said. I'll be right back. He ran into the store and bought 2 bottles of Coke, ice cold from the refrigerator. He got the clerk to open them, then returned to the march. When he handed a bottle to Joanne, she said,
Oh, boy, you're a lifesaver.
She put the bottle to her lips and drank a long draft. Woody felt he was ahead, so far. The march was good-humored, despite the grim incident they were protesting about. A group of older men were singing political anthems and traditional songs. There were even a few families with children, and there was not a cloud in the sky.
Have you read Studies in Hysteria?
Woody asked as they walked along.
Never heard of it.
Oh, it's by Sigmund Freud. I thought you were a fan of his.
I'm interested in his ideas. I've never read one of his books.
You should. Studies in Hysteria is amazing. She looked curiously at him.
What made you read a book such as that? I bet they don't teach psychology at your expensively old-fashioned school.
Oh, I don't know. I guess I heard you talking about psychoanalysis and thought it sounded really extraordinary, and it is.
In what way?
Woody had the feeling she was testing him, to see whether he had really understood the book or was merely pretending. The idea that a crazy act, such as obsessively spilling ink on a tablecloth, can have a kind of hidden logic.
She nodded. Yeah, she said. That's it.
Woody knew instinctively that she did not understand what he was talking about. He had already overtaken her in his knowledge of Freud, but she was embarrassed to admit it.
What's your favorite thing to do?
He asked her. Theater? Classical music? I guess going to a film is no big treat to someone whose father owns about 100 movie houses.
Why do you ask?
Well, he decided to be honest. I want to ask you out. And I'd like to tempt you with something you really love to do. So name it, and we'll do it. She smiled at him, but it was not the smile he was hoping for. It was friendly but sympathetic, and it told him that bad news was coming.
Woody, I'd like to, but you're 15.
As you said last night, I'm more mature than Victor Dixon.
I wouldn't go out with him either.
Woody's throat seemed to constrict, and his voice came out hoarse.
Are you turning me down?
Yes, very firmly. I don't want to date a boy 3 years younger.
Can I ask you again in 3 years? We'll be the same age then.
She laughed, then said,
Stop being witty. It hurts my head.
Woody decided not to hide his pain. What did he have to lose? Feeling anguished, he said,
So what was that kiss about? It was nothing.
He shook his head miserably. It was something to me. It was the best kiss I've ever had.
Oh, God, I knew it was a mistake. Look, it was just a bit of fun. Yes, I enjoyed it. Be flattered. You're entitled. You're a cute kid and smart as a whip, but a kiss is not a declaration of love, Woody, no matter how much you enjoy it.
They were near the front of the march, and Woody saw their destination up ahead, the high wall around the Buffalo Metalworks. The gate was closed and guarded by a dozen or more factory police, thuggish men in light blue shirts that mimicked police uniforms.
And I was drunk, Joanne added.
Yeah, I was drunk too, Woody said.